Welcome to the Wolfner Talking Book in Braille Library Podcast. Enhance your patron experience as you join us for the latest information, educational resources, and engaging interviews with the people working behind the scenes to ensure all Missourians may read. We are so glad you've joined us.
Welcome to the Wolfner Library Podcast. My name is Brandon. I am a reader advisor here at Wolfner Library, and with us today is our special guest, Richard McGonigal. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you here. Richard is the author of 3 full-length novels, with a 4th on the way, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
And numerous published short stories. Richard's books from the Sheriff Francis Hood series, Sense of Grace, Ghoul Duty, and The Forget-Me-Not have all either been recorded here in our Wolfner Volunteer Studios or in the process of being recorded. Be sure to contact your reader advisor and let them know if you'd like to read them. Richard, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate being here. This is a fabulous opportunity for me. I always, you know, welcome the opportunity to get I love what I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I get a chance to talk about it, and it's just wonderful for me. And it also gives me a chance to connect with readers. And that's why I do what I do. I mean, that's why writers write, is so that they can connect with their readers.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate this.
So first off, Richard, tell us a little bit about yourself and your history.
Okay. Well, I'm not a native of Missouri, quite frankly. I was born and raised on the East Coast in New Jersey. And I went to graduate school in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Okay.
And that was where I met the publisher of the local newspaper, Mrs. Betty Weldon. Was there. Her girls were in school out there at the time. And I worked on her farm and worked my way through graduate school, working at her farm. And when I was finished, I was kind of, you know, looking, I was thinking about being a professor. But the job market was terrible at that point. This was back in 75. And all the new grads were competing with people who didn't get reappointment or tenure, had 3 and 5 years experience. And so she asked me, she said, I know you are getting your degree in English literature and language, and I know you can write, and have you ever considered working for a newspaper? And I said, not necessarily, but I said, I'm open to all opportunities. This is why open-mindedness is such a valuable commodity for me. And she said, well, I own a newspaper in Jefferson City, Missouri. Would you be interested? And I said, well, absolutely. So I came out here and, quite frankly, I fell in love with Missouri and with the job. It was an opportunity to do what I do, which is write. And so I actually had a 41-year career at the Jefferson City News Tribune, everything from a cub reporter to the managing editor.
I was going to say, according to your bio, 40 years.
Yeah,
here, so the move was worked out for you pretty well.
Yeah, and that's pretty rare these days. But back then it wasn't so. I mean, you know, and for me to find a job opportunity that really clicked with what I like to do. You know, I got to write every day.
Yeah.
And I had a really great staff. And I mean, it was fun. These are really wonderful people to work with, you know. So if you've got great opportunity, you're great coworkers, and you've got an opportunity to do what you love to do, I mean, how am I going to say goodbye to that? So it worked out really well.
Yeah. So reporting on the news, you know, we all know it's sometimes stranger than fiction,
mm-hmm.
right? Kind of here, too. It seems pretty laid back for the most part, but we do have some strange things. But what kind of took you from being a news writer and news editor to wanting to do the fictional writing?
Well, there are two components to that, really. One is that I always loved writing fiction. I got an opportunity to do it in graduate school with a professor named Peter Taylor, who went on to be a Pulitzer Prize winner for A Summons to Memphis.
Oh.
And he was just a wonderful teacher, and he just had this love of storytelling that kind of rubbed off on me. So after my first daughter was born in 1985, I started writing short stories.
Okay.
And I had some success with that at, you know, some mystery magazines, including Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, and some small tabletop operations and things that paid in copies. But I was getting published, I enjoyed what I did. And so I wrote a story, and it was Ghoul Duty, actually.
Okay.
And I realized that this is not going to fit in a short story. This needs to be a novel. But I couldn't find a way to sustain what needed to be done time-wise with writing a novel and maintaining a full-time job. Yeah. Because I thought, well, I'll write in the evenings. Well, then it was bedtime, and I got to go to bed, got to go to work in the morning. So I thought, well, I'll write in the mornings. And then it was like, well, now I got to go to work. And so I thought, well, when I retire, I'm going to turn my attention to writing the novels.
Yeah.
And so that's essentially what happened. I retired in, 2017, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's when I turned my attention to writing the novel. Ghoul Duty was actually the first one I wrote.
Okay.
But not the first one that was published.
Okay.
And I couldn't make a connection with a publisher on that one. And so I was talking with some other friends of mine who do what I do, and they said, well, don't just keep, you know, rewriting, you keep putting all your eggs in the Ghoul Duty basket, you know, write another book.
Yeah.
And see what happens. And of course that gives you the opportunity to practice more, to learn more. And so that's what I did. I wrote Sense of Grace, and I connected with Sense of Grace, and that was my first book that was published. Then I had to kind of go back and rewrite Ghoul Duty because,
to make it happen
after, you know, the second in the series. These are not sequels per se in that the action, the characters continue,
okay.
but the action is different. The crimes are different. And you can read each one individually, independently. They don't have to be read in order. The virtue of reading them in order is that you get to follow the sheriff's growth, you know, as a person, and of course the changes, you know, in his family, and so, you know, some changes in the department, but otherwise the situations and the ancillary characters are all different in each book.
So how long has Sheriff Francis Hood been with you?
Well, he actually first appeared in some short stories.
Okay.
The first one, I believe, was called Probable Cause, and it was published in Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. It may have been in the 90s.
Okay.
And so he appeared in a few of the short stories, and that's where I kind of got connected with him. And what attracted me was he's not a tough guy or wisecracking, you know.
Yeah.
He's in recovery. He's a recovering alcoholic, and he has embraced some of the principles of recovery.
Okay.
And in terms of, you know, willingness and open-mindedness and love and tolerance and humility. And he tries to practice those principles in everything, up to and including his approach to law enforcement. And so he is a very empathetic character. I think he always looks at, he doesn't look at these people as necessarily bad, but flawed. And so... He has almost a kind of a connection with everyone, up to and including the most villainous villains that he comes across, which I think is a little bit different from what I've read, you know, with other characters. And so that for me is what differentiates him from the pack.
Yeah. So we've got three done, a fourth on the way.
Correct.
But you said there was kind of a major change for you as far as publishing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So. Yes. Well, my previous publisher, Cave Hollow, said to me after the third one that I was welcome to submit the fourth one elsewhere. And I took advantage of that. And I had met some people at some writers' conferences, up to and including one fellow author from Kansas City, actually. And she is connected with Level Best Books. And I asked her, I didn't know at the time, when I asked her to, if she would do a blurb. The blurb is what the other authors write on the back of the book, basically. And, you know, obviously that you use the ones that are
the good ones.
Yeah. And so anyway, she contributed a blurb to it. And so when I sent my newest one to Level Best Books, they said, we noticed that one of the people who blurb your book is one of our authors. How did you know her? And I said, well, we met at a writer's conference and we had dinner together at the awards ceremony. And coincidentally, I won a second runner-up for this book, actually.
For the Forget Me
Not. Yeah. And she agreed to do it. And so I'm pretty confident that they called her and kind of, you know, to, to see. And I know she gave them, because they even told me that she's kind of, they check me out, so to speak. And so I mean, sometimes that's how it works. I mean, the publishing industry has gotten pretty brutal.
Yeah.
For people who just, you know, just throwing them out there and hoping that they'll get accepted. There's a lot of competition. Yeah. There are a lot of people doing this. And so that was helpful. I don't know that it put me over, but it made a difference.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think between my history with the stories and the books and having a connection with Level Best, you know, all those things kind of just came together. It was one of those kind of fortuitous situations where all the stars align and suddenly I've got a 3-book contract. Yeah. So I'm really happy about that. That's going to carry me through 2026. And the fourth one, the fourth Sheriff Hood book is already written. That was the basis of them accepting me.
Okay.
And I'm toward the end of a first draft of the fifth.
Oh, okay.
So I thought if I kind of keep, I had deadline pressure every day for 41 years. And although I feel fairly confident that I can perform under a deadline, I like being ahead of the game.
Say, it must be nice to be ahead for once.
So that's what I'm trying to do. So, you know, I'm hoping that I will have, when my fourth book comes out, that I will be pretty satisfied with where I am on the fifth one. And then we'll see what hits me to start on the next.
So, see what goes.
Yeah.
So I think Brandon Lammer said that the Forget Me Not would be available to our readers at the end of this month in March. Yes. And then so the fourth book, you're saying, is November-ish of 2024.
Of this year, correct.
Okay.
So, and so when it will be available to your listeners, I have no idea.
But once
I get it, I'll bring it to you guys, and then you can do your thing. And I really appreciate your, you know, this is wonderful that you do this.
So have you gotten a chance to sit and kind of watch or see anybody record any of it?
I saw a little bit of that, but I was actually given one of the recordings so I could listen to it.
Yeah,
and it was great. It's very strange to hear something you've written read aloud.
Yeah, it's a different voice usually.
It is a different voice, but your narrators are fabulous. The one who did my book, I was really impressed.
Well, good. So one of the things I was going to touch on. So as a former editor, what is the editing process for you when you're writing a book? Is that tough to kind of let go of that and just write and let your editor do that job, or?
Well, I enjoy the rewriting process.
Okay.
Probably more so than the actual drafting of the book.
Main. Okay.
That process is still very, and I'm fairly inefficient at it. One of the things that, can I give long answers?
Yeah,
is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sure. I don't know if we have a time limit or not. So.
One of the things that you can edit me out. you can be the editor for that. When I went to one of the writers' conferences, they talked about that writers generally fall into two camps, two categories. The plotters, PLOTTERS, insist on having a plot first.
Okay.
Jeffrey Deaver, who is a mystery kind of crime writer, is probably the quintessential plotter. He's been known to create the plot outline that's up to 150 pages. And essentially, he just has to translate it into sentence form.
You fill in the
pretty
blanks.
Much, yeah. and then the other group are called the pantsers, PANTSERS.
Okay.
And because they fly by the seat of their pants.
I gotcha. Yeah.
And they may start out with a scene, a character, the smallest thing, and say, okay, that's the start.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no earthly idea where they're going with it.
And just build out from there.
it's like, okay, here we go. And off they go. And I'm somewhere in between.
Okay.
And so a lot of times it'll happen where, and a lot of mine are kind of, are almost thematic based, as opposed to, you know, I come up with a theme more so than the action. Okay. Like with my this one that's going to come out next time, a lot of it has to deal with fears.
Okay.
And so then it's like, okay, what kind of plot can I build around this theme? This fifth one that I'm working on is largely about control and managing, and how, you know, people try to manage situations, and how sometimes, you know, the more it gets out of hand, the more they try to, and you know, and so the attempt to control the chaos actually creates more chaos.
Yep.
And so, you know, I try to find out, okay, what kind of, you know, plot and mystery can I weave around these themes? And so somehow that's how it all starts for me. But then I'll get an idea and I'll just go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll get to a point where it's like, okay, that's not working quite right. And that's why I say it's terribly inefficient. And I'll back up, you know, to as far as I need to back up, and kind of take it from there and, you know, change some things and until I hit a wall again. And then I kind of back up. And
okay.
But I love it. I mean, I just love that process. But it can be terribly frustrating, mm-hmm. you know. Whereas the rewrite process, it's almost like there, I've got the outline. Now yes. I've got the outline. And now I can do the editing and kind of the playing and stuff. And a lot of times I'll know, you know, well, this character needs more development. You know, this, I need to figure, you know, explain to the reader why this works later. You know, I need to put a little more exposition up earlier. And I make notes to myself. And then I also put down my list of questions. You know, I need to ask. I'm in one of the virtues of, and I, here I'm digressing, going off on a tangent. I apologize for that. One of the virtues of having been in the newspaper business was I got to meet a lot of people
yeah.
who are, I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I'm not a physician. I'm not a prosecutor. I'm not in the judicial system, and so I have people.
You've met several of those people.
I know people who can do that.
Yeah,
and so I make a list. You know, I need to talk to the former sheriff about this. You know, and I have a list. And I need to ask the prosecutor about this, this, and this. And I need to ask the judge about, you know, and then I need to ask the doctor about. And I have these people at my disposal, which is nice.
Yeah,
they've been very gracious and very kind to do that, and people love to help you if you just ask them.
Absolutely.
You know. And so that's what I do is I go and go back, and the rewrite process for me is, you know, filling in the blanks and fixing this and repairing that and you know, and rebuilding this that didn't work and asking these questions and filling in the blanks and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The virtue of having, and now I'm going to get to your question.
Okay, you're good.
15 minutes later, is that. The virtue of having been an editor is I respect the editorial process.
Okay.
And I am not one who goes, well, that's how I wrote it. That's how it's going to be. I have had great editors. The Cave Hollow editors were wonderful. And, they made some suggestions. And they were and the beauty of it was they didn't basically change it. Mm-hmm. They said, here's what we'd like you to change. And they gave me the latitude to do it. And almost without an exception, their suggestions were really wonderful.
Yeah.
They were very good. And I was really happy and willing to make those changes. And it meant a fair amount of work because sometimes I had to rethink some things.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately the book was better because of it. And so I'm kind of looking forward to, I have no idea what the process will be like with Level Best. But I do know that there's a point where I engage with the editor and we'll see how that goes. But it'll be a new experience for me. But I'm not worried about it because, like I say, I feel like editors are there for a reason.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like I have always felt like anything that I do, at least everything that I found that I have tried to do, there is a way that it can be done better if I am open to listening to people who do that.
Yeah.
Or and readers too. You know, readers are, I love going to book clubs and talking with book clubs and getting reader feedback. Because I know what the story is when I put it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
When you're coming to it the first time, if it doesn't make sense,
yeah.
that's on me. It's yeah. not the reader's fault, you know. And so when a reader tells me, "Well, I didn't really get the visual image of it." My job is to put you there,
mm-hmm.
you know, to put the reader in that spot, to feel what they feel, to hear what they hear, to see what they see. And if I haven't done that, if I've left you confused somehow, then I haven't done my job right.
Okay.
And I need to know that.
Yeah.
Because it's up to me to fix it. If I'm going to get better at this, I'm going to have to get better.
Absolutely. That's a good answer.
Thank you. took me long
sorry.
Enough.
No, that's good. So tell me a little bit about the Forget Me Not. That's the next book that our readers are going to get to listen to.
Correct.
From. Well, they can mm-hmm. listen to all of them, but that's the next one that's coming. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what Sheriff Hood is into in the Forget Me Not.
Okay. Well, the theme there, the starting point for that was really, how does our past and our memories influence our behavior going forward?
Okay.
I've met a lot of people who, and I am a product of, my past experience and what I've learned and what I've known. And I've met a lot of people who sometimes are traumatized by their past. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, how do I explore that kind of thing? And so what I have is the closest one to using the actual mystery format, where you've got a crime and you've got a certain body of suspects, kind of in the same place at the same time. And it's a family, basically. It's the Bishop family, and the father has disappeared. The patriarch. And he's not only the family patriarch, he's also the owner of a local newspaper. Imagine that.
Imagine.
write what you know.
Yeah.
And I had originally had it with some other business, and I thought, no, I know the newspaper business, and I know some of the ins and outs of this, mm-hmm. and I can use that as part of the plotting device, so that's what I chose. It really has nothing to do with, the former owners whatsoever. It's, these people are made up out of whole cloth. But I know the business, and part of that plays into it in terms of the economics and financials of the business. But anyway, a bone is found coincidentally by the sheriff's daughter in the woods, and it turns out to be a human bone.
Okay.
And they eventually track it down and realize that what they're dealing with now is a homicide, not a missing persons case.
I got you.
And so now he's got to figure out, and the family alibi kind of collapses. And so now he's got to figure out who among these family members may or may not have been involved and how. Among the family members is a former classmate of his who has a mental condition, a neurological condition, called hyperthymesia, which is very rare. And if people know anyone who has it, Mary Lou Henner, who was Elaine Nardo in Taxi,
the series.
Okay. She has it. It's acute autobiographical memory. And from a certain point, the person can remember everything that has happened in their life. It's almost like downloading a DVD, and you can see it. It's just like replaying a tape in your mind.
Hmm.
And she has that. And so this family member, who was actually a stepdaughter, becomes kind of his ally because she remembers everything about every family gathering, who said what they were wearing. But she's also a prime suspect. She's also among the suspects. And so then there becomes, that tension and give and take, among the family. So that's kind of the setup for it.
Okay.
And I probably told your readers too much, but there's more to it. But that's kind of the backbone of the book.
Well, we're looking forward to that then coming. So just a couple other things. I mean, writing influences. Who has kind of been your biggest influence that you can think of?
My favorite living American author is Joyce Carol Oates.
Joyce Carol, okay.
She is not a mystery writer per se,
mm-hmm.
But she puts a lot of kind of mysterious, gothic-oriented, off-the-wall elements in her writing. And it's just the way she writes is just so visual. I love reading her, just regardless of the story. Mystery-wise, I'm a big fan of I'm trying not to blank here. Hieronymus Bosch is Michael Connelly.
Yes,
Michael Connelly's detective, and I really like. He is a very inventive, and he has three books that feature a newspaper or sometimes former newspaper writer, Jack McAvoy, the poet, the Scarecrow, and another one I forget the title of it. But I really appreciate his storytelling is wonderful. I'm a big fan of James Lee Burke, who writes the Dave Robichaux, right? And I really love his description, particularly the atmosphere that he creates. I mean, I really feel like I'm there, you know, in those Louisiana bayous with him.
Yeah.
J.T. Ellison is a writer from Tennessee that I appreciate very much. He's got several series going. There are a lot, and and everybody influences me in some way. One thing that I try to do is, and I'm doing it now, is each year the Mystery Writers of America has an award called the Edgar Awards, and they have nominees in each of three novel categories. And usually at least five nominees. So that's 15 books when the nominations come out to read. And that's what I'm doing now is reading the Mystery Writers of America Awards. And I found some real good ones in there.
Okay.
Jess Laurie, among the writers that, you know, that I have met at writers' conferences that are nominees this year, Jess Laurie is one, J.T. Ellison is one. I've never met Tracy Clark, but she has one, and I really appreciate what she does. S.A. Cosby has three now, and he's an up and the boy. He's got some. Yeah. I just finished one of his, and he's good. So they're out there. They really are. There's no lack of books, and you know, and between you guys and the public library, let me just say something about libraries and librarians. You guys are wonderful. The things you do to help readers, you know, literacy is, I think, you know, a foundation for any kind of growth and civilization. And sadly, not enough people take advantage of it. To have free books at your disposal, I mean, that is absolutely wonderful. And it's not used nearly enough. You know, when I go into the library, it should be packed.
Yeah.
You know, I should have to wait in line. And I rarely do. And that's sad for me. So,
well, we thank you.
Absolutely.
I don't really have anything else. I'm trying to think of anything to touch base with. I was going to hit on retirement and seeing if you had enough time to actually write, but it sounds like you do.
I make it a point. You know, there are some things that I've embraced. And a person once said to me, you know, retire to something. Don't retire from something.
Okay.
Because quite frankly, there was a certain reluctance to retire.
Yeah.
If there was anything that, there were two things that motivated me, a negative and a positive. The negative was how the image of journalism has changed.
Yes.
And that because I came into the business in 75, which was not right around the Woodward Bernstein era,
yeah.
Where journalists were seen as a bright shining light, the purveyors of truth, justice, and the American way. And, now we are the purveyors of fake news.
Yes.
And I get that because I kind of see the bias and prejudice that goes into the news business. And so, there was a time when I was, you know, when I would, you know, proudly say, you know, I'm a journalist, you know. Mm-hmm. And now I kind of put my head down and say, well, kind of mumble it because, you know, it had gotten to that point where we just weren't as highly thought of. But the local news people are still, they're wonderful people. They really do try to do, with what they're doing with the election, really trying to inform the public and not turn the public one way or another. Yeah. And I appreciate that. The thing I retired to was writing writing books.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that, and I had the opportunity to do that. And so with those two things kind of combined, I thought, okay. And I really haven't looked back. I miss the people I work with. Writing books is a very solitary thing. You know, I go into the office, and there'd be, you know, a dozen plus people there, and we'd all work together on a common, you know, we got to put a paper together. And that has to happen. I mean, we do that every day.
Yeah.
And that was that teamwork and that camaraderie was really, you know, really a lot of fun and very challenging. And now, you know, other than my deadline, which is a book a year, and I'm ahead of it.
Yeah.
So there's not really any kind of pressure necessarily, but I just as a self-discipline,
yeah,
I typically, you know, spend a certain time every day doing it. And
that's kind of what you got to do. We just keep writing.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the questions I get a fair amount is, you know, where do you get your ideas?
Yeah.
And, you know, I always say, you know, ideas are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I just kind of ask the what if question. You know, you look at something and it's like, yeah, okay, but what if this were to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of where you take reality. Because, quite frankly, you know, writing is really a combination of my experience, reality, and imagination. And so the what if question is kind of a combination of both right there. One of the short stories that I wrote. It was the first one that was published in Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. It was called Mysterious Ways.
Okay.
And essentially the story is that a person is killed and a tornado lifts their casket up during the burial, and eventually the casket collapses on a rooftop and kills the killer.
Okay. All right.
So where did that come? Well, what if? And it was a what if. It was my maternal, my wife's grandmother. We were at a service, and it was in this small church in some place in Missouri that I don't even think there was a signpost. It was, you know, a couple stores and a church. And after the service, we came out, and the cemetery was right across the little gravel road, and it was raining, and they were carrying the coffin and puddles, and the sky just turned dark. I mean, it was, you know, and I thought, what if there's a storm? You know, thinking, I don't have an umbrella, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's the first thought. What if there's a storm? You know, how am I going to protect myself? And then it was like, what if there's a tornado? And what if that tornado picked up the car? And all of a sudden, here, you know, and so that's how stories for me, I mean, that's how they start. It's just, you know, the kind of the what if, and you start carrying that these almost illogical extremes. And, you know, and it can really germinate, it can be the seed that germinates the story.
Yeah. So, and you use real life stuff too with it.
Oh, yes.
The flooding of the Missouri River.
Sure. Yeah, that was directly from the Hardin Cemetery.
Yeah.
I mean, that was from I got that idea back in 93 when the first flooded. And I thought, somebody's got to go and retrieve those coffins and those corpses.
Yeah.
And what if they find somebody who didn't come from there?
Yeah.
You know, and then what?
Yeah.
And that was really the germination of that idea. The Sense of Grace was largely about, you know, what if person who commits the most despicable crime it gets loose, and the sheriff has to kind of protect this guy.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of conflicting feelings do you have when you're trying to protect the worst of the worst?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these are just those kinds of what if questions, and sometimes they just kind of rattle around in here and kind of take on these strange possibilities and storylines. But that's a lot of fun as well.
Well, good. Yeah. As a 51 year resident here of Jeff City now, thank you for everything with the News Tribune. You can read it still basically every day. So,
appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they're still doing good work. They did a heck of a job with this. They had, you know, the election promotional stuff. And you know, that was some of the people that I work with were the kind of the person, people who said, this is going to be important. And I'm glad they're doing it. You know, I really am.
Absolutely.
I do a good job.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Absolutely.
It has been a pleasure.
You.
Absolutely.
We would like to again extend our thanks to Richard McGonigal for sitting down with us for this interview. To request one of his books, you can contact a reader advisor at 800-392-2614. Or download the titles directly from Bard. Sense of Grace, DBC 19466. Ghoul Duty, DBC 24319. the forget-me-not, DBC 24447. Thank you again, Richard, and happy reading. Thank you for listening to the Wolfner Talking Book and Braille Library podcast. For further inquiries on this episode, or for library service needs, you may contact us toll-free at 1-800-392-2614, by email at wolfner@sos.mo.gov, or visit us online at www.sos.mo.gov/Wolfner.